Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I'm Michael Zalavari, and joining me today is Oliver Trovis. Good evening, Oliver.
Good afternoon.
Oh, yes, because we're... No, it's not afternoon, is it? It's morning for you.
Oh, sorry, good morning.
Ah, this is all... I'm all bent out of shape. Just a few admin things before we properly start. Firstly, we have a YouTube channel now. We will be posting our episodes up onto YouTube as well, just as still images. And we'll also be using it as a place to facilitate some sim racing commentary that Kiwi and I have been doing for Automobilista Australia. So you'll see that up on our YouTube channel, which is called Endurance Chat Media. And also, if we ever actually get around to producing some visual content, like some lap previews or stuff like that, that's probably where it will end up as well. So keep an eye on that and subscribe to that if you want to do that. But we actually have some racing to talk about, finally, Ollie. Actual racing, well, actual virtual racing, kinda, I guess. But we had the virtual 24 Hours of Le Mans 2 weeks ago now, which was the weekend of what should have been the actual Le Mans. They ran something like 50 cars in R Factor 2, a split between 25 LMP2 cars and 25 GT cars, and it actually went okay, didn't it?
Yeah, like a lot of people say, you know, the cars aren't real, but the racing is, and yeah, it's certainly exciting if you can get past the visual barrier. Yeah, I think they did really well with that kind of visual barrier, because I've had people say they're not that into sim racing and stuff, and they were getting in contact saying, hey, did you know this was on, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually.
Yeah, and they were kind of having no background in sim racing or watching sim racing. They thought it was pretty good, you know, using the official graphics package as well. It added like an extra polish that kind of took you out of thinking it was a sim race.
Yeah,
kind of a little bit.
I will 100% say that the fact that they used the full WEC graphics package and, you know, had Martin Haven in there and the production of the, well, the full production of the event, you know, having the Freitas and the real WEC team do the race control, McNish doing interviews. I think that part of it made it feel a lot more real, as compared to maybe, say, another sim race where it's only just, you know, in-game graphics or the in-game overlays that, you know, makes it feel like a bit of a video game. Because honestly, a lot of the proper sims nowadays are looking a little dated with their in-game graphics. It kind of makes you feel like it's a video game. But yeah, honestly, like, even the graphics and the stuff around the track made it look like it was Le Mans. And I was actually watching, I wasn't intently watching the virtual Le Mans, but I had it on one screen and the 2014 Le Mans next to it on another screen. And the day-to-night transition was almost exactly the same. It was kind of uncanny, but over the uncanny valley, it looked real enough that I was convinced. So that was a pretty decent achievement. I'm pretty happy with how it looked, because it looked like a real thing.
Yeah, it broke down those barriers. And the same thing with a bit with audio. The audio wasn't quite there, but having the commentary team as well preserved was kind of countering over that, and also having the officiating crew, Eduardo Freitas, like you mentioned, it kind of validated that side of it, taking you into thinking it was real. And yeah, the graphics was really polished, and the whole day night transition, unfortunately we didn't get to see rain, which R Factor 2 can do, which, and that was kind of, I think, one of the reasons people were saying that that game was chosen, but we didn't get to see it because I think it would have been a bit too much for the server.
I
we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that later, but I recall hearing that in practice, whenever they tried rain, it basically broke the server each time. So you make the best you can with what you got. I will say that I was very impressed with the tone of the production as well. I think that's something that needs to be talked about extensively, because it was as if they knew it wasn't the real thing, but they were willing to give it enough seriousness to fool us while also keeping that lighthearted edge. So, for example, having McNish, Christensen, and Capello in a video call together through one of the safety car periods just to sort of share some stories and have a bit of a banter, that was really, really good because it didn't detract from, you know, a real race, but it also was a nice thing to fill in some slow time overnight as well. So I think they nailed the tone.
I think that it gave them like a bit of free rein as well to experiment with different things because they weren't kind of constrained to the rigid traditional setup. Like they could take some risks and, you know, do these live interviews and connect with all of these people. It's kind of similar how you would have these pit lane interviews with drivers and team managers and people like that. But then the difference was you could then kind of spin away and do a 20-minute deep dive that you wouldn't do with a pit lane interview because it would kind of detract maybe. But this, it was kind of a bit of an additive. There were some kind of other detracting factors, like the concert, which was a bit jarring. Like, it was good, but I think it really was a hard cut away from the race, such that when it came back, or the race came back with the full screen view, it was like, the wait had been over, you know?
Well, they have a proper concert at Le Mans, don't they? They have like is it near the Ferris wheel where they have like a full 2-hour pumping EDM thing?
It's next to the Dunlop Bridge.
Oh, okay.
It's up the hill by the Dunlop Bridge. And usually like they don't put the headline act during the race. Usually it's like Friday night.
Yeah, okay.
So it's kind of a bit like background noise, I would describe it, in the real race. Whereas here, it was front and center taking up most of the screen. So it was kind of a flip there. So I think that was maybe a bit too much. But having the connection with all of these past legends, like who'd have thought this single broadcast would have all of these legends talking through everything? You know, you wouldn't think that a sim race or a kind of thing that
the computer game basically, like if I told you 10 years ago that we would be sitting down watching a computerized Le Mans and being excited about it and think it was a good time, like you just wouldn't have believed it. It would none of that sort of big sim racing community that we have now would have been around back then. So the fact that, you know, esports and sim racing has come so far and they're able to port an event like Le Mans, maybe not, you know, exactly to fully fledged background like you see in maybe some other esports like Counter-Strike or Overwatch or League of Legends or whatever, but the fact that, you know, you can do this sort of thing and people will be interested in not only gamers and people who are on the electronic side of it, but people who enjoy the motorsport side of it and the legends of motorsport are going to be in it as well, and it gives the full treatment. Like that's phenomenal, and the fact that they actually managed to get it to work was actually pretty good. I was pretty impressed. I had no expectations, but in the end I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, and like I mentioned before, you know, it was connecting people that didn't necessarily have that much interest in WEC. They might dabble with 24 Hours of Le Mans, let's say. And I have people, I knew of people that attend, older audience that attend Le Mans, that have attended Le Mans and have nothing whatsoever to do with sim racing. And they tuned in and were also impressed because it's kind of bringing lots of different genres together that wouldn't normally kind of connect. And the same thing with sponsors. I've heard about sponsors that have joined this that wouldn't normally, or that have, this gave them an opportunity for new sponsors to join and new partners to join, and it's kind of like a little extra bit of growth that wasn't expected during this time of year.
And on top of that as well, not just new sponsors and new businesses, but new drivers as well. I think the fact that you had half a field essentially of professional established real world drivers and half a field of professional established sim racers was a interesting and in the end, quite well executed way to set up the entry list, because it meant that you had people who had backgrounds in sim racing, who had followings in sim racing, bringing again the sim racing fans to the event, and then the people like the big high profile names like Charles Leclerc or Lando Norris or Max Verstappen bringing in their own fans and bringing not just fans of their sim racing but fans of F1 and fans of other motorsport, you know, fans of Dakar and people from all around the world to watch these guys do what they do best, which is drive a car, maybe not a real race car, but yeah, they were driving a car. So that was really, really cool. And even like having the likes of Jimmy Broadbent feature in the race as well, again, to bring in more of that sim racing fanship. It was like a nice little connecting and overlapping of worlds, not just in racing, but in esports as well. So yeah, it was actually quite well executed. I was very skeptical about the mix of the pros and the sim racers, because in the end the sim racers were just better. We're gonna get that out of the way right now. Like the sim racers, the people who were doing it, who do sim racing for a living, were actually better than the professional race drivers. How do you feel about that?
It does feel weird, like,
yeah.
So I don't have that much I don't want to say I don't have much interest in sim racing, but I don't follow it that much. So the names weren't that obvious. They didn't stick out to me unless they were some of the top front runners that I've maybe watched, like the Formula One pro esports kind of connection where there were the Williams team and whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I think there is a niche for it. I think it was nice to have them with the real life teams and real life cars. And there were even full entries that were just transplanted from the FIA World Endurance Championship and just dropped in the game. Like even pro-am entries in P2, they just took even the amateur driver. So you've got like they were saying the pro IRL real life drivers, they were the ams in the sim race, but then you've got the amateur real life drivers in the sim as well. So that's like another level of removeness from the real world. They were taking it. But I think it was cool to see the real life teams even like copying the same liveries across. I think that was pretty cool to kind of connect the real world and the sim world. And then you had, like, for example, the Rebellion team that were going the extra level and even doing historic liveries from their past, seeing as, you know, this will be the last year of their operations or their last season of real life operations. They were kind of doing a tribute to previous entries with the gold Lola, the red and gold and white Lola livery, but then the obviously collider paper, having to mix with the Williams at the back. Yeah, I think it was good to see the connection with the pro sim racers. I wasn't really up to speed with who they were, but you know, I'm only speaking from my point of view, and they're going to be people who are really, really, really into sim racing, who have a massive connection with these people, and maybe not so much with the real world racing drivers, and have it completely flipped the other way around. I think having the real world drivers made me have a connection with the cars and make me feel like it was a real race.
It adds a tendency of legitimacy to the event. You know, the fact that you've got, you know, recognizable teams, recognizable drivers, people that you're already used to seeing racing these cars in these liveries in this environment, but now just ported over to a virtual sense. It made it feel a bit more real than compared to, say, the iRacing 24 Hours of Le Mans, which is all esport teams.
For me, it's a sort of connection of a human is driving that car.
Yeah.
If it's a name that I've never heard of, I can't really connect to it. And it's as if it's like, now this is pretty rude, but it's like as if a random name generator has pumped a name onto an AI car. Like,
yeah.
And an AI is like a really advanced AI is driving that car. It's kind of like Robo Race.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the thing moving around the track. Whereas if I know that there is a connection between a a name that I know, their wheel in their bedroom or living room or whatever.
Or bicycle room, and, apparently.
Yeah, and they have that then controlling the car in the game. It's like another human connection that my brain makes, and I can't really describe it, but it feels more on the real side, whereas if it's a name that I've never heard of, it just feels disconnected a
yeah.
bit more, and a bit more on the virtual than on the real world kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like this kind of weird spectrum where the pro drivers are maybe to bit more for me towards the believable
yeah.
side. I don't know.
I think that's fair enough. And I share that same sentiment. I'd fully 100% admit that until someone asked me on the Monday whether or not we were doing a race thread for it, I was completely going to ignore it. It was only when someone said, are we going to do a race thread, that I was like, okay, I should probably actually figure something out so that way people can watch this event and I can facilitate this for people watching the event. And as I said, I had no expectations going into it because I don't really follow sim racing. I mean, I follow sim racing in a local sense with the stuff that I do, the commentary stuff that I do for series with that through people that I've met through here, you know, for Automobilista Australia and that sort of stuff. But, you know, beyond that, I don't really care. So the fact that, you know, again, someone like you or me who cares about real racing, not really about sims, was able to sit there and enjoy that event and, you know, feel like it was a adequate substitution was actually a pretty good thing. I do want to just backtrack a little bit. The note that you touched on about the pro drivers feeling like an AM class, when compared to the pro sim races, that's actually a really, really interesting point. You could definitely see some teams that had people who had experience in sim races before. Like, for example, we talked about Lando Norris and Max Verstappen, Charles Leclerc, those sort of guys who have experience. They really were a step above what we would have expected when compared to the pure out-and-out sim races. And I think the team that ended up winning, which was the Rebellion Williams, the number one team, which had their pro drivers, well, their real-life drivers of Raffaele Marchiello and Louis Delatraz. But yeah, you could clearly see, though, that Delatraz and Marchiello had put in a few hours in the sim because they were almost on pace with the sim racing counterparts, who were both Polish, so I'm not even going to try to attempt to say their names because I don't want to embarrass myself that much. But as you said earlier, when the racing might not be real, but the competition is, sorry, the cars may not be real, but the racing is, and there was actually some quite enjoyable racing throughout the event. I think GTE was typically what we expected from GTE. You know, there was nose-to-tail battles of 10 to 15 cars for hours on end. There was a great battle at the top of the field between a few of the names that we would have expected in WEC competition. You know, talking about Toyota Gazoo Racing, talking Rebellion, and actually Bicolors. Bicolors, for most of the race, were dominating the event. So there was actually a decent exhibition of racing as well, which again, I think helped legitimize that. Although in some instances, there were some very, very high profile failures or incidents which made you adamantly aware that it was a sim race. And I think the biggest one that people were talking about were the red flags. The two red flags that we had, I think one was at about 6 hours into the race, the other one was with about 4 hours remaining, for yep. server resets. Now, yeah, how did you feel about that? Because of all things, a problem with the game, having a red flag for a problem with the game would be the last thing the organizers, the teams, and the race, like the game developers would want in that sort of setting.
Yeah, they kind of tried to justify it, and I do agree with how they justified it in terms of the commentary of saying it's kind of like having just the same as a barrier repair
yeah.
or something like that.
A safety car for debris or something.
Yeah, and you have a out of the ordinary issue with the circuit that you need to fix. You know, we had, what was it, Dubai 24, where the whole track was flooded and things like that. And it was, only like 7 hours long?
Yeah, or even at Le Mans, where they had the great kick-up at the exit of Terre Rouge last year, and they spent an hour and a half, welding that back down.
And then the cement or something that needed to set, so there was always a slow zone there for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, and it does mirror real-world racing, but having no justification for it. Like, if there's a barrier repair, you can see a replay of that car hitting the barrier and then that barrier deforming and needing, there's like a justification. Whereas if you see, even without a car blinking, and they get like a warning on their servers saying there's something wrong, that we need to fix it, as a viewer, you watch the cars circulating, you have some battles, and then suddenly Freitas comes on the radio saying the circuit is red, the race is red flagged. It was kind of a bit jarring, and but on the other hand, it's better that way than having what happened to the Red Line Racing car with Max Verstappen on board at the time, where they were blinking and lagging and eventually crashed. They were given their opportunity to get back in the race, but they unfortunately rage quit.
Just a little. It was unfortunate in those instances that the like game glitchy sort of things, the you know, blinking around, I think Alonso had a glitch or like a coding glitch where he got a drive through on the lap that he had to pit for fuel, and so it wouldn't let him refuel the car. He had no fuel to go around and do another lap. And then I think there was also problems with the Charles Leclerc GT Ferrari that ended up on its roof for some netcode reason. It was unfortunate that those incidents, those little things, happened to the high profile entrants, because otherwise the game ran, besides those two red flags, pretty well flawless in the end.
Yeah, there was a lot of load, a lot of people connecting on, lots of cars, lots of, you know, each car had four drivers, so there were loads of connections to the server all at the same time. So yeah, it did pretty well. And like we mentioned earlier with the connecting to the real world kind of red flags, you have the kind of similar things as well with each driver's like sim rigs as well. You know, it doesn't necessarily, fate or luck doesn't necessarily, you know, affect only the worse on paper drivers. Yeah. You know, you mentioned the famous names having problems. You know, there are mechanical problems that happen to everyone. You know, even if you're leading Le Mans after 23 hours and 46 minutes, you can still break down, you know.
Every time, every episode, we got to reference that. It's a rule.
Well, I mean, it's law. And the same thing happened, you know, you'd think, oh, Team Penske in America, they are, you know, the best at crossing every T, dotting every I, you know, preparation. And there was still a sim rig failure with Simon Pagenaud's stint. So he had to have, he borrowed a sim rig from a friend, had it next to his current one, unplugged his that broke, did a hot swap of changing the seat around, brought the second seat in with the wheel, connected it up, limped back to the pits. Just like you might have, you know, some sort of failure in the real world, it happens in the sim racing as well.
You can tell he's a Penske driver, or you can tell that he's worked with Penske, because who the hell would think to have an entire rig set up ready to go just in case something goes wrong? Like, that's,
it's as if it was scripted.
Yeah, exactly right. Actually, now that you've said that, that does sound a little fishy.
There is eight.
Wasn't he also on camera at the time as well?
Yes, he had a face cam that was live, and they were showing like he was stopped by the side of the road, and then he was kind of playing around with his wheel and trying to work it out, and then decided to do the rig swap. And yeah, the same thing happened with Robert Wickens. You know, he had a really complex hand control setup because of his injuries, and yeah, there's it's more difficult to get that kind of setup right because it's a bit more tricky and unique and bespoke. But, you know, there are still these sorts of mechanical issues where he was driving one-handed because he had his right arm on a brake lever, kind of like Zanardi did at Daytona. And there was a setting for the kind of...
the force feedback,
strength,
right?
Yeah. The strength of the wheel, as it were. And he was on max setting, just trying to wrestle. And he was doing loads of stints just back to back to back because they screwed up the management of the team and he was just doing drive time. But yeah, these things happen in the sim world and they happen in the real world too. You know, let's not forget there are mechanical issues that come out of nowhere on these cars. There are, you know, drive time calculation issues that happen, especially in ACO or sports cars and endurance racing where you've got multiple drivers, you've got to balance the drive time. You know, it's not like this is only a sim racing problem, as it were. It is the same. You know, we can't use it as a slight on sim racing.
Yeah,
because
it's analogous to the real world. Although to call back to the point you made earlier about it, you know, having that justification for say the red flags. You know, if you've got barrier pairs, you can see it happening, and you got to wait for it to be fully repaired before you can go again. It does feel a little weird. I feel a little like off that, you know, there's a problem not necessarily with your equipment or your connection, but the game's connection to you or something like that. This does make it feel just a little unjust. Whereas
there's an expectation.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes that expectation wasn't met. But again, for the most part, it was met. It was just that the people that fans were coming to watch were the ones that all had the problems. It was funny that, wasn't it? It was Leclerc, it was Verstappen, and it was Lando Norris and Jimmy Broadbent, you know, four of the big names that people were planning to watch and expecting to do well that were the ones that had major problems. And Alonso as well. And let's not forget as well the fact that you mentioned before about the Team Redline being allowed back into the race. Alonso as well was allowed back into the race after his car was stopped on track. Alonso's team, we'll clarify.
Thank you.
And they gave back a 60 lap disadvantage or something like that because, you know, but when they reset the server, they were like, okay, the game's restarted, you can come back in and resume as if you were a part of the race. So what do you think about the handling of that that aspect of it?
So they had a call, a video call with Rubens Barrichello, who was also driving that car.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't drive that car at the time. And he'd done all the prep, practice, putting in the laps, doing testing, that sort of thing. And he was just pleading, just crying to Freitas, just like the real world, I guess, for a break. Just please let me drive. Because, you know, it's kind of a bit unfair. When you look at it in that aspect. But then, yeah, it won't work in the real world getting given 60 laps. Like, sure, if they were towed to the pits and then they spent hours repairing the car just to limp home, as it were, because the whole spirit of it is finishing and getting to the finish, and they were given the opportunity to be put on a flatbed truck, as it were, and then taken back to the pits, like you might see in some series that allow it.
Not in Le Mans, though.
Nope, famously. And it's as if they found a jerry can by the side of the road, hidden under a bush. But also, you can't find a 60 lap freebie in a tree, like by the side of the track, to try and mirror it to the real world. That's the kind of thing that took it a bit out.
I guess
they weren't competitive anyway, and it didn't matter.
Yeah, but I think that is the more important point: the fact that it didn't matter. If it had mattered, they probably wouldn't have done it. But the fact that the tone of the event wasn't, you know, this is super serious and we're competing for the world's biggest motor race, but this is a semi-serious, but more importantly, time and event filler that we're doing in a professional way to sort of fill the gap. What was it? I was talking about the V8 Supercars E-Series in the same way, and then someone said that that was a very mature take, so I'm going to go back and find that because I am proud of that.
Brag about it.
I know. I mean, I'm running. I'm hosting this podcast, so it was a bit of fun professionally set out with a finish line to fill the void of the event that should have been there. So I think in that situation where it is at the end of the day meant to be, you know, a bit of fun to fill an event slot, they allow, you know, allowing a 60 lap deficit for one of the teams that is going to be the most popular team is not necessarily justified, but, you know, okay in that sense. Because, again, they did the same thing with the Redline Sport. They gave the offer to that team to come back in after the second red flag. But of course, by then, Verstappen and Norris had uninstalled the game. So,
I think it's kind of handing out an olive branch to some of the biggest fan bases as well. Having experienced Alonso's first race at Le Mans in real life, having shared the grandstands with all of the masses of Spanish people who didn't really know what Le Mans was about, but just turned up because Alonso was there, kind of thing, there is a massive draw. And the same thing would happen with Charles Leclerc, and the same thing would happen with Lando Norris's massive fan base and Max Verstappen as well. And, you know, having them still, just even if they're turning laps, will get people clicking. Yep. It will get people watching, and it will get people looking at sponsors, and it will get the analytics up.
That's, I think, you know, perfectly fine in the end. I think it caused a little bit of controversy because, you know, as many as there are Alonso lovers who will tune in just for Alonso, there is also a significant portion who would just want to tear someone like that down. And we've seen it on WEC stuff as well. You know, whenever there is any mistake with that Toyota car when he was running it, it was like, oh, Alonso, why is he even here, et cetera, et cetera. Because people just can't have nice things is the thing at the end of it. But I think, you know, you're exactly right. There was a commercial argument for allowing that car back in as well, which, yeah, as I said, in an event like this is perfectly fine.
There was one thing that I kind of wanted to ask a question to you about.
Yep.
Was with relation to the broadcasting and how it was presented on YouTube for free, and the viewership was massive in terms of them in sharing the analytics and the viewership numbers and the engagement of the fans, and how this was a massive event with loads of people clicking and everything. But then the real product is the one that's behind the paywall. Now, I completely respect the paywall kind of model, but wasn't one of the justifications of using the paywall having better analytics than what you could get on YouTube? So it kind of is a bit of a weird statement. So what did you think about, like, the accessibility of the virtual 24 hours of Le Mans compared to a real 24 hours of Le Mans that's kind of hidden from public view?
Okay, so I think I'll talk about the virtual one first. I think they did a lot of effort into pushing the event as something that would get a lot of eyes, and you know, getting the professional drivers involved, the big sim racers involved, the guys like Verstappen, Norris, and Leclerc, and then also offering it free on YouTube, offering it free on Twitch as well, so putting it basically in the market that they were trying to access, and then as well free on Facebook. I think they did a very good job marketing the event and getting people on board to watch it. Now, the difference between the virtual Le Mans, I think, and the real Le Mans is the real Le Mans is enough of an event, enough of a draw card on its own that people will pay to watch it regardless, right? Like, if you and me, me definitely,
it was worth it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have paid to watch that. Simply because, as I said at the top of the show, I'm not generally interested. So offering that to me for free, or if they had included it in the WC package, I probably would have tuned in anyway. Now, for the people who would have wanted to see these big names for a one-off event, I don't think you can justify trying to get people to pay for it if it is just going to be a one-off sort of thing, which we'll talk about a little later. It might end up being a one-off thing. So
I think, though, to retain them as a counterpoint, just as a devil's advocate, do you think to retain those new fans that might have caught a little bit of a taste for endurance racing and the World Endurance Championship, do you not think, though, that it would be better to a better way to retain them to then retain that model, to make it easier for people to access the race, for it to then grow its viewership?
That's an extremely difficult question. I don't know the marketing situation or the business model behind the WEC. So
tough question.
Yeah, it is a tough question. I'm going to say no. And part of the reason I'm going to say no is because the WEC isn't necessarily in the position where it can relinquish the broadcast product without having people pay for it. And this is something I talk about a fair bit when comparing, say, IMSA or LMS broadcast to the WEC broadcast product, and that is the broadcast product. And that is where I think, again, this is pure speculation. I know nothing about the financial model of the WEC, but I would expect that getting people to pay for the broadcast results in a better broadcast product, be it graphics, be it overlays, be it commentators, be it camera shots and that sort of stuff and replays. I think if you get more people to pay for the broadcast, it enables you to do more things with the broadcast. And I look at the comparison between the WEC and the ACO broadcast versus, say, IMSA. And while IMSA is great for what it is as a free product that's broadcast around the world to all the different markets, I don't think as a broadcast product, not saying anything about the commentary, not saying anything about the information, but as a broadcast product overall, I think the WEC is a better product. And I don't think you can sustain the quality of the broadcast without having people pay for the stream. It would be different if, for example, we went back to 2016 and the ACO said to the three factories that were in LMP1 and then the further three factories that were in GTE Pro, hey, if you want to help us broadcast your product and help use us for advertising, you should bankroll this and we get that same product. I think if we went back in time and did that, we might be able to sustain it. But I don't think in the current climate, you could do that.
Yeah, I think just to round that off, it's like, I find it easier to share an ELMS product or an SRO product that is accessible on YouTube, because I don't have to explain anything. It's just send a link, hey, you can watch this.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
On your TV, you can easily cast it onto your TV, whatever. Whereas if I want to talk to a friend about, or a colleague about WEC, it's going to have to be, oh well, then you need to download this app, then you need to subscribe to this app with this payment, and then you get to watch it.
Yeah,
or you wait a month and then you get to watch it back. You know, it's easier to get over that hump of them then becoming interested in it, you know.
Yeah,
it's an extra bit of faff. It's a barrier.
And it's an accessibility problem in that respect. Yeah, and that's not necessarily an easy problem to solve. And I'll fully admit, you know, had I not stolen the stream, essentially, I'm going to out myself here, had I not been given an opportunity to steal my way into watching the 2014 season, I probably wouldn't have kept watching WEC, because it was too big a barrier for me at that time. But because I was able, because someone was generous enough to give me their streaming details so I could watch alongside with them on two separate devices, that I was able to watch that season, which is why I then became the super fan that I am now. So it's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of things. because you don't want to be exclusive and shut people out. But on the other hand, being exclusive enables you to do more things with it. I don't know. It's a really difficult question.
It's really difficult to answer because there are so many different points of view that are justifiable.
Yeah.
You know, like you just mentioned. But yeah, anyway, thanks for indulging me.
No, no problem. And I'll just, again, another tack on to that conversation. I think the fact that they had such high-profile names makes it... you want to reduce that barrier to entry as much as possible so that way you can get a cast as wide a net as possible, especially for, you know, what we'll call an exhibition event, which this is. You know, Le Mans isn't really an exhibition. It's, you know, the pinnacle, whereas you call this more of an exhibition of, hey, look at what we can do. And in that situation, I think, yeah, having it as easy to watch as possible is probably the better... whereas with Le Mans, because it is so prestigious, you can almost, you know, ramp up the cost of that.
The virtual is a loss leader, whereas the real life thing is where you make your money.
Yep, exactly. Basically. Exactly right. We should actually talk about the race in some respect, though, shouldn't we? We've talked about the context. We've talked about, you know, what it means for the ACO and what it means for fans and all that sort of stuff. We haven't actually talked that much about the race, have we? And the last section of the race was what I really wanted to talk about, because that was the only real section I tuned in for, and it was because you told me exactly what was going to happen and it played out exactly as you expected.
Well, there were two options. There were two ways it was going to happen. And the one hand was the number one Rebellion was going to have to make another pit stop and do a splash and dash. But then the pit stop time was very similar to the gap to second place, which was the Bicolis. And the Bicolis managed to eke out their fuel a bit longer, such that considering a stint length would take normally about 35 minutes in the game, they had timed it so their last stop was about 30, was pretty much bang on 35 minutes to go, whereas the Rebellion was 37 minutes to go. So it was kind of, the Rebellion's probably going to be either A, on fumes and is going to be doing maximum fuel save and loads of lift and coast and therefore turning slower lap times and not being able to then fend off the Bicolis, or they're going to have to go full gas and then do a splash. But then you've got the risk of, you know, being slow in taking time at pit lane speed limiter kind of thing, and stationary in the pit box.
It was exciting.
It was nail biter. Yeah. You know, we had the live timing up. We were checking out each lap, like how the gap changed and ebbed and flowed. Then there was the wingman, as it were, with the teammate of the leader, the Rebellion. There was another Rebellion car in the mix that was trying to slow down and hold back the Bicolis, which was in third at that point, and charging through. I thought it was really exciting because there was so many ways that it could have played out when the Bicolis was third. You know, they still had to get past the second Rebellion, which they eventually did with a wicked pass in the Porsche curves.
Oh yeah, like, that was crazy.
Wow.
Around the outside in the Porsche curves. Whoa.
Yeah, it was really, really, really good, you know. And it's something that it felt reminiscent of a 4-hour LMP2 race.
Mm.
You know, how the mix up of strategies that a 4-hour format allows with the stint lengths of modern LMP2s. You know, you've got maybe they do a splash. Normally the 4-hour events, for context, if people don't normally know, it comes out to a splash and dash at the end, and it's how long these cars are going to be stationary, and it all evens out after the last pit stops. So you're kind of not quite sure. You can have an indication because, like, how hard they've been pushing, that sort of thing,
or if there's any safety cars.
And it just comes right down to the end. And I can't remember the exact time gap, but it was really close. And the Rebellion winner eventually had 0.5 litres of fuel left to do the cool down lap. Like, it passed the line with less than a litre of fuel in the tank, and then eventually had to be pushed back around the cool down lap by the competition, basically. Yeah.
And it was really, yeah, it was absolutely tense. It was kind of reminiscent. The one that springs to mind for me was, like, for example, the Fuji 2016 race, where you have those two different strategies, one car that's hobbled but with track position, the other car that's charging back and trying to do the overtake charge through at the end. And yeah, at the end of the race, it was 18 seconds that was separating the Rebellion and the Bicolors. Yeah, it was actually quite tense and quite enjoyable. I was very well impressed with how that race ended. And it felt like a real Le Mans in that sense. You know, the buzz around the community in the chat room, people tracking the times, people discussing what was happening, and then the build up to the finish. It felt like the real deal. And I think the serendipity to bring that finish to life probably did a lot to make that event, you know, resonate at the end. You know, had it been a race where the leader had finished two laps ahead or a lap ahead and there wasn't really a competition, I think it might have been forgotten about. But people will remember that finish for a long time, and as a result they'll remember the race and they'll remember the production for a long time as well. In saying that though, Bicolors and Rebellion, how ironic is it that those were the two teams fighting for a chance to win at the end?
Well, yeah, and
and Williams.
Bicolors got pole position as well.
Yeah,
which was like, whoa, ridiculous. It kind of did feel a bit weird. And then when you have that back to back with like Toyota Gazoo Racing, who have arguably the best drivers in the real competition, how they were kind of limping around. Now that is obviously because they hardly used professional sim racers.
Yeah,
and that kind of highlights the gap. But yeah, they really hit the nail on the head with their pro drivers, the real world drivers and the pro sim drivers. You know, they got really good teams. Bicolors was kind of off the cuff with how they ran their entry, you know, cobbling together some sim races to go with some real world races. Whereas the Williams was, you know, a professional outfit, a pro sim team. Yeah. It was a bit weird to see those names at the front, but I would rather have it that way than have a
Red
professional
Line
sim team
yeah.
name being at the front, because, you know, like I mentioned with the drivers, I also connect with the liveries
yeah.
and the team names, and having real world team names at the front maybe helped as well with getting excited about the finish.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The fact that it was two teams that will compete in the LMP1 class of Le Mans this year, chasing down the win, definitely made it resonate more with me. It felt like it was a WEC race that was on a simulator, not a simulated race that happened to be the 24 Hours of Le Mans. But it was good racing in the end, and yeah, quite a bit of a nail biter. Now, a discussion question I wanted to pose to you, and if, for the people who are in our live chat, feel free to add points as you see fit. A, did it work? And B, will this become a regular feature? Will we have an ACO sanctioned 24 Hours of Le Mans virtual in conjunction or alongside or before or after the real 24 Hours in the future?
So I went into this, I think, the same way you would have in, or that you did have rather. I didn't really have any expectation. I just went into it thinking, okay, it's something to watch, you know? It was just to fill a gap in my weekend and, you know, to kind of make do with not going there that weekend for the real thing kind
yeah.
of thing. And I think that's why I enjoyed it so much, was because I had no expectation going into it, so anything would be a win. I think it was a success. I think they did it right. It felt right with how it worked. You know, it felt like they'd struck a nice balance with everything. But, you know, whether they can do it again, I'm not so sure. The vacuum in real world racing kind of made this happen,
yeah.
as it were, and made it so good. And also, we wouldn't be talking about all of the legends tuning in as much if this happened again alongside real world 24 hours of Le Mans. Yeah, they would be in town if it was happening in the same weekend, but they would be preoccupied. Like CPX posted in chat just now, you know, the real world drivers and the real world legends are going to be a bit busy during the real life 24 hours of Le Mans. But also, you've got so many clashes. You've got so many series every weekend now on the calendar. It's so busy getting these real world racing drivers to do this kind of event across the grid. You know, it will probably never be able to happen again.
Yep.
So this kind of event will probably therefore never happen again. And it will probably be way more aligned with across the scale of sim race. So, or pro sim race. So you're going to have the pro sim racing teams. You're going to have the pro sim racing drivers. And like I mentioned before, to someone like me, I would be less inclined to tune in to that because it's going to be more of a different piece of content to something that I would prefer to spend my time on. And having it side by side with the 24 hours of Le Mans, I'm not going to spend my time because I'm already burning out,
you know,
watching the full thing, you know, diving headfirst into all of that because the grid is huge, you know, and the driving, all the storylines across the grid of the real life thing is enough to, you know, 24/7 fill someone's time.
Yeah.
There is an existing Le Mans esports series, but I've never watched it. I've got to be honest. I think it happens at Le Mans during the Le Mans week, but I've never really seen it.
Yeah.
I don't know who's taking part. So, you know, it does exist already, but maybe if they bumped it up and, you know, put a big push behind it and they have the side by side kind of thing, or maybe during Passage, you know, the scrutineering, you would have the
virtual,
or maybe the test day, the Le Mans test day weekend, you would have the race, the virtual 24 hours. Maybe that could work. But yeah, I don't think this kind of thing will happen again in the same format, because it was just kind of a product of the world we're in, you know.
Yeah.
Before racing comes back.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. To answer my first point, yes, it absolutely did work. Yes, it filled a Le Mans weekend that I was very sorely missing, and I feel I from what you've said, it sounds like you were sorely missing it as well. But I you're right. I don't think it can happen again like this, because you're simply not going to get 100 professional drivers at least to fill these teams in this sort of way. There are, you know, a bunch of professional drivers who do spend their spare time sim racing. We've mentioned a bunch of them already, but I'll also add, for example, like Nicky Team to that list as well, because they do compete. Some of them do compete in the iRacing 24 Hours of Le Mans, the Sim Series 24 Hours of Le Mans, which is the weekend after. But I don't think you can get a fully produced event run by the ACO, run by the WEC, with the same commentary, with the same race direction, with the same teams and drivers in that way ever again. I think you're right. It's a product of this world that we've been dealt in 2020, where we have a lot of sports people, and a lot of people for that matter, with a lot of spare time on their hands and itching for something to do. It's a very interesting, as we'll call it, an exhibition event. I used that word earlier. As an exhibition event, as a one-off, it was phenomenal. They did a fantastic job with it. But yeah, it is almost, the more you try and do it, the almost the more it would become dilute in that sense. And there's no way you could ever get a race that wanted to take itself in any sort of seriousness, a sim race that ran alongside the 24 Hours of Le Mans. There would just be no way that would ever happen. So, yeah, it's I don't think it's comparable to the real thing. Certainly didn't feel like the real thing, but it got close. And for this year, it got close enough, I think.
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned, they got a good balance. I think they hit the nail on the head, as it were, and it filled a vacuum. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what convinced me the most that it actually did its job?
Well, the fan engagement.
Oh, like, that was fine. I was okay with the fan engagement. There, the community engagement in here.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
In here. But for me personally, it did something that I've only ever experienced at Le Mans when watching Le Mans. The post-Le Mans depression was real. I still felt that afterwards. I still felt like a little burnt out, but like a happy burnt out. And it lasted like for 2 or 3 days. I was sitting there on Tuesday being like, why do I feel so burnt out? It's like, oh yeah, because I watched Le Mans over the weekend. Yeah.
Just trying to unpack everything gradually.
Exactly. And I don't get that feeling with Daytona. I don't get that feeling with Nürburgring. I don't even get that feeling with Bathurst. It's a completely different feeling at Bathurst. Most of it is just like, oh, I got to travel back home. But yeah, the post-Le Mans unpacking still happened. And I think that for me was a sign that the virtual event did a good enough job to fill the void. So I'll pay that. I'll absolutely pay that. Yeah, so, and by the way, there was also a GT class, Porsche one, because they had the Porsche iRacing sponsored pro players, and also Nick Tandy as well, which was hilarious.
BOP.
Yes, because BOP in R Factor 2 was a big issue. I gotta say, the Corvette team and the Aston Martin team, especially for the Corvette team, who had a bit of an incident with an LMP2 car, earlier on the race, to recover and finish second was actually quite impressive. But yeah, it was fully expected that Porsche were going to win GTE, and they did what they did. So congratulations to Porsche.
They took it pro. Like they got this. I think they had a team of 30 people. I think they said, Nick Tandy said on an interview, they had like of their real life professional engineers and strategists and data engineers and people at Weissach.
Oh, they don't. Porsche don't do anything by heart.
They didn't fuck around.
No, they don't.
and it shows.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly right. And I think no matter what Porsche do, they always go the full neck deep in. So they did well, and they thoroughly deserve the victory. And Nick Tandy can very proudly say that he's the only current driver who has a 24 hours of Le Mans overall victory and a virtual 24 hours of Le Mans class victory. So well done, Nick Tandy. He was very excited in the post-race interview that they went to. Enough of virtual talk. There's real racing next week. Well, there's real racing now, but there's real sports car racing. There's real sports car racing already, but no, there's real IMSA racing next week. We're back. The ACO, or the worldwide sporting umbrella has its almost top level racing finally starting up next week. It's a 2 hour and 40 minute race at Daytona, which I think will be the first non 24 hour race using the road course since a very long time. Since the 70s or 80s or something. I've never actually seen a race at the Daytona road course that wasn't the 24 hours of Daytona. So this will be very interesting.
Well, it's going to feel like a prototype challenge. MPC, like, you know, where you got the GT4s and you've got the TCRs. Whatever class, I don't care.
It's TCR, yeah, TCR and GT4 is the Michelin Pilot Challenge. It'll be an interesting way to return to racing. Well, I mean, it'll be also two consecutive rounds for the IMSA Championship at Daytona, which I don't think they've ever done two rounds at adjacent rounds at the same track before, never mind the 4 month wait in between the pair of them. But another interesting thing to note is that it's going to be the first time that IMSA has raced in America over the 4th of July weekend for, I think, a number of years. Because what tends to happen is they do the last weekend in June is the 6 hours of the Glen, and then they have the next week after that is Mosport, which is generally 4th of July weekend. So actual American patriotism in America for a change. Say hello, all the Americans in the chat.
We're going to have a brilliant national anthem, We're going to have loads of jets flying over. We're going to have
army demonstrations
everywhere. It's going to be hand on heart across the crowd that won't be there.
And I think they're letting in 2,000 people, I think. There are a not insignificant number of tickets being sold to this event, because I remember seeing Cookie Monster saying on his Facebook that he was going to both Daytona and Sebring this year, and then and then Sebring in friggin' November as well, because of course he is. Bloody bastard. Yeah, so
he has to endure living in Florida, though.
That's true. Yeah, so you know, if you have to live in Florida, I guess you know there has to be some perks, right? we're just roasting America, and none of the Americans are even on the podcast to stop us. This is great. There are a few important notes though with Daytona. Firstly, the entry list has taken a major hit, not so much in the prototype and GT Le Mans classes, because of course they're pro funded and pro run, so they're the factories running those, and you know the way that the factory makes money is by marketing, and that's how they're going to do that. But especially in GTD, there has been some massive hits to the entry list. So remember, it's also the start of the Sprint Cup season as well, so there is a kind of a changeover in that between the Endurance and Sprint Cup. So that means that we do have entries coming in from Compass Racing in the McLaren 720S, Gradient Racing running an Acura, and then Rick Ware Racing and PPM. Who's PPM? Oh, wait, no, sorry. These are the entries that haven't made it. So Compass and Gradient Racing are going to be there. Now, Rick Ware Racing and I don't know who PPM are. But the important thing about this is that they're not going to be there. So they announced that they were going to be there to bring cars in. It was going to be an Audi and a Lamborghini. They've fallen through. And then a second Wright Motorsports Porsche has fallen through as well. That's including the loss of the Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini and the Gear Racing Lamborghini, which, if you've missed that news, Gear Racing are basically pulling out of running the Lamborghini in IMSA. So that's with the all-female lineup, which is now currently looking for another team to run it. So there's actually only going to be one Huracan in the GTD field, which will be the Magnus Racing team. Also, Pfaff Motorsports aren't going to be there because they're from Canada and they can't get down to Florida. And Heart of Racing Aston Martin aren't going to be there as well. So in total, comparing the GTD class from Daytona to the GTD class at Daytona, I'll check that. Comparing the 24-hour entry list to the 3-hour entry list, it's 12 cars in GTD for this race, and I'm going to find how many cars were at the last Daytona race, because I have a feeling it was something like 23. So it's a massive difference in entries in the GTD class. Yeah, it kind of a sign of the times, isn't it, with where we're at in the world at the moment, because that's a huge reduction in entries.
Yeah, I think there are several factors, you know, like you mentioned with the international travel. We've got teams across North America that have to travel to Daytona. So you've got the border between Canada and the United States of America that I believe is still closed. So Pfaff are stuck and beached to the wrong side of the border for Daytona. But you've also got the drivers and the team members and mechanics and strategists and whatever coming from all over the world to make sure that they're there to race. And if you've got a paying am in GTD that can't make it across, the entry probably won't be racing, because you know they're there, that what they're paying for is that they want to get the drive.
Yeah.
And if they're not getting the drive, then the entry is not going to happen. But also the teams, any OEMs that are backing potentially the teams, they are pretty running low on money right now. And to reduce expenditure, you're going to reduce the number of races, and that's just taking a hit. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, as I mentioned, it's just a bit of a sign of where we are at the moment, because you can't really run a race team if there's no one bringing the money in for it. And not only the AM drivers, funding the teams, but most of these AM drivers have their own businesses and their own, the way that they make their money is being affected as well. And I mean, it does sound a little insensitive to say that this pandemic has certainly reduced the number of race teams that are going to be around the world because the lack of AM drivers lack of people being able to fund teams, AM drivers being able to fund teams when, you know, people around the world have lost loved ones, lost ways of life, lost careers, etc. I'm kind of sorry for saying that, but if we just focus on just the sports car side of things and ignoring the rest of it, we're going to be going through a very lean time in terms of maybe even grid sizes and participation in top level series around the world, just simply because of what's going on and the run-on effects of that. On the other hand, I'm sure there's other AM drivers who have done very well and have managed to make money from this. So it's a full mixed bag. But yeah, I think it's a 8 or 9 car reduction in GTD field, which at Daytona is probably going to make the traffic seem like an absolute breeze in comparison to what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. You know, it would still be a bit of a mess if they were all close together in a train.
Yeah,
you know, that'll still be pretty difficult to pass. But and also I want to pose another question to you with this is, you know, could this be a benefit for the LMP2 class, being potentially cheaper to buy a seat, as it were? So if you've got an AM in GTD that's running a bit low with their business profits and whatever, or their personal wealth, maybe moving to LMP2 might be a cheaper option to them and still keeps them racing and fuels their addiction, but more reasonably cost efficient, as it were.
Why would this
could be a benefit for P2?
I'm not sure. Maybe in Europe, it might be a bit more applicable because you have a very healthy P2 class already, which means that you're, I don't know. Honestly, I couldn't say either way, because the question I would have is, why would you want to run P2? If you're going to run prototypes in America, you're probably better off running Prototype Challenge and a P3 car, because a P2... I don't think there is the logistical support to offset the potentially cheaper running costs. Because part of the reason I think LMP2 is cheaper in Europe is because you have that logistical support basically everywhere. Whereas if there's only two cars in America that are running in P2, there's not really going to be that much logistical support, I don't think. Why would running a P2 car be cheaper than a GTD, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I think it's cost effective potentially, in terms of, you know, if you were having to help provide funding for that OEM to pay for the manufacturing
marketing good point. Fee. Good point.
For example, Compass Racing with the McLaren. Now, I don't know the balance of funding or whatever of how this works, but if you were, let's say, the only GTD of an OEM like Compass Racing are with the McLaren, if the amateur was helping fund that in the business model and the funding structure, it would make more sense to me to become an amateur in a LMP2 team, that you might be sharing the load with another amateur in a more potentially cost-effective car. You know, LMP2, yes, it is very expensive, but it is still surprisingly cost-effective. for a way to get up to speed in motorsport, in top level motorsport. Well, IMSA top level, but
just going to keep firing the rest.
We've already commented on that. But yeah, I think maybe, you know, it could be not necessarily a good thing, but it could be a little spark that LMP2 needed in the over in the States to kind of regrow after the DPI class bit. I don't know.
You certainly raise a good point that the manufacturer buy-in to IMSA is not insignificant. It is I think it's something in the realms of $1 million or around about that to represent a new manufacturer, and part of that is money, part of that is marketing money, part of that is analysis, data analysis, BOP fees, and then a part of that is activation. So if you are, for example, Compass Racing and the sole car for that manufacturer that could, as you said, be coming out of the customer's pocket. Yeah, whereas if you wanted to run an Orica or a Ligier, or even, you know, maybe jump on board a more popular manufacturer, say a Porsche or an Audi, or hey, Lamborghini's got a bunch of spares now that no one's going to be using. Maybe if you wanted to jump into a Lamborghini, you could potentially do that. So yeah, you raise a good point. The thing is, I still don't see P2 as an attractive product in America. That's the thing. That's the thing that's the stopping point for me as a product, as a racing product, as a and not
after
in terms
the class split.
Yeah, after class split, definitely.
Yeah.
Not pre-class split. Pre-class split, you know, in the days of Core Auto Sports and
exactly.
The Banana Boat and the Red Dragon, you know, that was peak IMSA. But after the class split, there is no, it's not a good racing product. I don't mean that as a viewing product. I mean that as a participation product. You know, I don't think a Ben Keating really wants to be beating around a bunch of chiropractors every weekend. is that too mean?
I mean, you got dentists as well.
Oh, okay. That makes it okay then. Chiropractors aren't okay, but beating around dentists is great fun. Yeah, but you know what I mean? It doesn't seem to have an attractive competitive product to bring people, bring amateurs in. Like, why would you run P2 even if it costs $100,000, $200,000 less for a season when you could run a recognizable GT car against a highly competitive field? I don't know. If I had the money, I wouldn't do it. If I was in the States, in Europe, though, it's an entirely different story.
Yeah, if you wanted to brag to your mates, though, as well, you're at the golf club or wherever you waste your time as a really rich person. If you want to brag about it, being in a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or whatever is pretty accessible and understandable to your other filthy rich friends. So, yeah.
Yeah, you can't really tap someone on the shoulder and go, hey, you want to check out my Orica after this?
Slow down.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, where were we going with this?
You don't want to know.
Yeah, okay. Real racing is back, by the way, guys. Real racing is back. Do you want to remind people who are in these teams for these events? Because it's been, what, the 24 hours of Daytona, which was the last race, was literally 5 months ago. 5 months ago yesterday.
Jesus.
Yeah. So there's... who are even in these teams anymore? So DPI is still Mustang Sampling, which is now JDC Miller Motorsports, because remember we've had the split of Action Express where they're only running the 31 car, which is now the Brazilian effort because it's got Felipe Nasr and Pipo Durrani behind the wheel. And so JDC Miller are running basically a pro car and an AM car nowadays. So they've got Barbosa and Bourdais in one car, they got the double Bs, and then Chris Miller and Tristan Vautier in the other car. You've got the two cars from Mazda. Interestingly, no Timo Bernhard and no, who am I looking for? Brenton Hartley for those guys anymore. So they're the drivers that have been lopped off from the endurance group, yeah. And also, you know, probably can't get into the country at the moment. And then the Konica Minolta team of Van der Zander and Ryan Briscoe. So no Taylor at all, because Jordan Taylor is now with Corvette Racing, of course. See, this is why it's good to go back and have a look at these entry lists, because I have no idea where half of these people are driving anymore. And then the two Penske cars, which haven't changed all that much. GTLM has no Risi, which is entirely unsurprising considering the circumstances, and it is just going to be Corvette, BMW, and Porsche. We did comment earlier on in the year that Porsche are pulling out of GTLM in IMSA competition, right? We did say that. I think so,
but still, it is, you know...
That's pretty big news.
Really a big move.
Yeah, and that kind of spells almost the death knell of GT Le Mans. I don't think GT Le Mans can really exist if it's just Corvette and BMW.
Like, yeah, and the BMW team, yes, they are successful and they do perform well. It is, you know, it is incomparable when you look at the likes of Porsche and how professional that outfit is. It is going to be a tough time ahead for the GTLM class.
We might have to look at doing an investigation into what the current GT worldwide situation is at the moment, because that is an absolute can of beans at the moment. Can of bean worms. It's a mixing metaphors. It's a can of wormy beans. Can of jumping beans.
Yes, and this might be the uncorking of the...
Of the can of beans.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. And then finally, GTD. We've got two Lexuses from AIM Vassar Sullivan's. Lexuses. A single Porsche from Wright Motorsport. Acuras from Gradient Racing, which is a team I've not heard of before. And then the Heinricher Curb with MSR, Curb Adgejejan. Two of those. So we'll see those two cars out on track, the 57, the 86 that we're used to. Audi is represented only once by Team Hardpoint, which again is a team I've never heard of before.
Team, yep.
We've mentioned the single Huracan run by GRT Magnus. A single Ferrari run by Scuderia Corsa, a single Mercedes run by Aurelia Motorsport, a single McLaren run by Compass Racing, and a single BMW run by Turner Motorsport. So the only multiple car manufacturers on the grid are the Lexus and the Acura, which does not compute. Obviously there's something weird with this class considering where we are, but if I was to tell you, you know, in January that, oh, by the way, the next time we have IMSA racing, we're going to have a single car from most GTD manufacturers, like, that sounds ridiculous. I think that's the most diverse and most diverse yet smallest GTD field we've ever had.
Especially when you compare it to the NLS that happened yesterday, where you've got, you know, so many Porsches, so many BMWs, so many Mercedes. You've got this kind of onslaught of GT3 cars, and the same thing we're going to have with GT World Challenge across the world, you know, and IGTC. You've got all of this strength in depth. And if you tell someone that there's only going to be one Porsche GT3, it's going to be like, what?
What? You know, a single Porsche?
It doesn't make it makes sense, but it kind of still feels a bit thin on the ground.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a testament to GTD's competitive strength that we're saying that a 12-car field is a lean field. A 12-car field for basically any class is amazing. A 12-car field in WEC is ridiculous. But we're saying that a 12-car field here in GTD is lean. Like, it's a testament to how strong the GTD field has been for so long that we're worried about its depth when we have a class larger than any WEC class that has ever been.
Yes.
Cool. Glad you agree. Any final notes before we wrap it all up, Ollie?
Gear racing. That's unfortunate that they've cut ties with Grasser. Recently, I think last week.
Very recently.
That's unfortunate. And then I don't know if it's tied to, but it might be tied to the whole Beer Figueiredo embezzlement issue.
There's a Beer Figueiredo embezzlement issue?
Yes. I think it was her husband and father-in-law have been arrested and she's under investigation in Brazil. And they've, as a family, embezzled like over $118 million from the Brazilian government.
Wow.
Yes.
I completely missed that.
So, Bea Figueiredo formerly racing with the name Ana Beatrice, I think. And, I don't know if this is connected. So that means that they are not going to be running the Lamborghini anymore because that's run by GRT. But then this makes me think, does this put their Le Mans entry in doubt? Or are they shifting funds from IMSA to the 24 Hours of Le Mans entry? Or, you know, is the funding coming from this embezzlement money? I don't know. Could they be, because they're running a Ferrari, I think, in GT Pro now at Le Mans, would they be then taking this Ferrari and converting it into GT3? Because they aim to return by the end of the IMSA season to GTD. Could they be maybe trying to do that? Just a shower thought, you know.
pretty extensive shower thoughts. Man, you must have long showers. what's wrong with me tonight? I am so weird. Yeah, that news had completely blown by me. I knew that there was a split between Gear and Grasser, and I'm trying to find more information on that now. But yeah, I completely missed all of that. Wow. Okay, that's certainly news. Yeah,
and it's a big shame because, you know, I really want Gear to be a success and to even be associated with this sort of problems after only racing one race at Daytona as Gear. It's a shame and I don't want to see it.
Yeah, 100%. 100% agree. Also, just briefly should mention there was further date changes and clarifications for the IMSA Championship. So they've, I think, brought a bunch of the events forward 1 week, including VIR, Watkins Glen, and Lime Rock. And this is important because it avoids a clash between the 6 hours of the Glen and the planned Intercontinental GT Challenge race at Indy is where it is now. So it basically means that there's now a gap in the schedule between Lime Rock and IGTC, and then... And the reason that they're doing Lime Rock is because apparently Lime Rock is right next to Watkins Glen in relative terms. Before Laguna Seca has been pushed back to the penultimate round of the season, so a little bit of rejigging as has been painfully obvious throughout this time. A lot of the championships are running by the seat of their pants in terms of where things are going. For example, supercars have just changed their entire calendar for the second half of the year again as well. So we'll have more clarity as time goes on. But I just want to say, holy damn, it is so nice to have racing back. It's so nice. I will never take sport and racing, even just to sit down and watch, I will never take that for granted again after this 4 month layoff.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate when the races are on. Like I mentioned, the NLS came back and had its round one, I think, of 2020 the other day.
In June, in the end of June.
it felt really comforting.
Yes, that's a great word to use. Yeah, comforting.
To have that. It was gezellig. Yes.
And translation for those who don't speak Flem? Not Flemish.
It can't be translated. It's like what is it in Denmark or Swedish or, well, it's all the same really, isn't it?
I think you just by conflating Denmark with any Scandinavian country, I think you just offended a lot of people.
Is it hygge or something like that? That's like comfy and snuggly and cozy.
It is, and honestly, we had the supercars finish off their first round back today, and just seeing the cars on track, seeing everything, having racing, proper racing back again. As much as we've, you know, said that the Virtual Le Mans was a great thing and we very much enjoyed it, and it filled an event slot that was meant to be Le Mans. As much as it's been good to have that, it's just not quite the same as having racing back again. You know, it's just been very, very nice to just get back. And it, like, yeah, I don't really know where further I was going for it. It's just been nice. It's been comforting. It's been good. After 107 days, it's been good to have racing back in Australia, and next week racing around the world in America, and then in subsequent weeks back in Europe. I think we're only 3 weeks away as well from the Paul Ricard test for European Le Mans Series, and then they've got their European Le Mans Series race that next weekend. So it'll be... It'll be back on before you know it. It'll be back on before you know it. And thank God for that. And on that note, I think it's time to end the show. Thank you very much, Ollie.
Thank you for having me.
No problems. Once again, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our new YouTube channel. I'm going to be that obnoxious dude. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for sticking with us. I hope we've been able to give you some decent content in the massive hiatus of racing we have. But yeah, damn, it's good to be back, and it's good to have racing back again. I've been Michael Zalavari. Thank you very much for listening. Peace out!
Like, subscribe, and hit that bell.
Hit that bell! Smash that bell, baby! I hate myself.
Yeah. Welcome to the club.
I feel gross. Oh, shit. I got to start the rewatch, don't I?
I thought you were about to say start the recording. Jesus Christ. You gave me a heart attack.
You know, in the first season, the first year that we did this, Cookie actually did that once. We did an hour and a half podcast. Hurts. And yeah, he forgot to press the record button.
That makes me sad and hurt, even like having no being not affected by it one bit. Just the association of cringe,
yeah. And it was someone else. Oh, and like, even though it was like us shit tier in our like fourth or fifth episode, it was like, oh no.